Mercy Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate. Kia ora and welcome to a Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation, and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, social justice, the Mercy World, or the Catholic Church. Today, my visitor is Dr. Nicholas Thompson. Nick, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Thanks.
Nicholas, or Nick, is originally from the South Island of New Zealand and is senior lecturer in theological and religious studies at the University of Auckland. He specializes in the history of Christianity and the late medieval and Reformation eras in particular. In a few weeks, our Lutheran brothers and sisters are going to celebrate 500 years since the beginning of the Reformation. Here in Auckland, we are going to have an ecumenical service on the 31st of October in our St. Patrick's Cathedral. On the 30th of October and on the 6th of November, Nick Thompson is going to give a presentation at our Mercy Spirituality Center. Therefore, I thought it would be a good occasion to introduce our presenter on Muffin Talk. As I mentioned, Nick, you are specialized on the history of Christianity. Where does this interest come from?
The history of Christianity is something that I've always been interested in. I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in it, and I guess that was probably because my parents were interested in it too. But I did my original university degree in English and Latin, and then I went out into the workforce. I remember I was flatting in Dunedin, and I had a flatmate who was doing a theology degree, and she used to leave her notes out on the coffee table in the living room. And I remember one day looking at the reading she was doing, and I this is quite a mercenary way of looking at it, but I remember thinking, gosh, imagine if someone paid you to read about this, wouldn't that be wonderful? So I went back to university, did a theology degree, and here I am.
and some parents think that historians can't make a living.
Well, that's true. I was always told as well that it was pointless learning Latin because Latin would get you nowhere, but it's got me a job.
Well, at school, I also learned Latin, but it said when you know Latin, you have the roots of many, many words that are in the scientific areas, so it's never bad to know some Latin.
That's right. And I mean, it also helps you with all of the Romance languages too, which is something I've discovered later on. I can recommend it.
And one of the areas of expertise that you are having now is the intellectual history of Reformation art. What is that? Can you tell us more about this topic?
So with all history, there's different ways of coming at it. I suppose originally a lot of history was very much concerned with national politics, and if people were looking at the church, they tended to be looking at the hierarchy of the church and the institution and the relationship between the church and state. And in the 20th century, that began to broaden out. People became interested and the experience of the ordinary people. So sometimes we talk about social and cultural history and the way that the ordinary people have shaped the face of the church and shaped developments in it. Intellectual history simply means that I'm interested in what people were thinking about, usually what they were arguing about in the history of Christianity. And that's because intellectual historians believe that ideas, in some way, have a life of their own. Not all historians believe that. Often, especially Marxist historians will say that ideas or ideology is simply a product of economic and social circumstances. But intellectual historians tend to believe that ideas, for better and also for worse, can often make people act in ways that are counter to their economic or social interests, in ways that might sometimes seem irrational, although often are very rational. So in terms of the history of Christianity, what I'm looking at is the history of the debates that shaped in the long term, the way Christianity is now. And as you can imagine, in the Reformation, there's an awful lot of those debates going on. They become quite intractable. And to be honest, after a while, they get quite tedious. You begin to feel reading these Latin texts, oh, for heaven's sake, just stop it.
You say, for heaven's sake.
But it's often, often it becomes like one of those endless spats on Twitter where people just can't put down their phone or their computer mouse and just go away and have a cup of tea. They just keep at it and at it and at it. And my job is to follow those arguments through to their bitter conclusion.
But I think that started already with our pre-Christian history.
Yeah.
And when I talked to a rabbi recently, he said there's not a Jewish view, there are Jewish views. And
yes.
And I think that it has always been like this from the beginning. And there were discussions. Even Abraham had discussions. Moses had discussions. And I think that it must be part of humanity.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I mean, that's right. Right. When Christianity begins as one Jewish movement among a whole multitude of Jewish movements, and it does what other Jewish groups do with each other. You can see that in the New Testament. And then it begins to develop a diversity of its own as well.
Yeah. And our history, the Christian history, had lots of schisms.
Yes.
And so there have always been discussions.
Yeah, right, so from the very beginning.
And they were not necessarily emotional. So they were, many of them were intellectually, but predominantly intellectual, how would you say it?
Yes. So if you're reading, for example, Thomas Aquinas or any of the other medieval scholastics, where in a sense disputation is institutionalized, it's part of the way of doing things in the university lecture hall and classroom, then it very rarely feels passionate. It's almost as though it's just talking heads following through a procedure in order to get to a particular answer. But in there's no question but that in the Reformation and right into the 17th century, it's passionate. They're really, and most of the people arguing, in some senses, are fighting for their lives and their existence, because very often there's a threat of bloodshed hanging over the disputes, or at the very least, you know, political marginalization. So sometimes the invective can be absolutely scorching in this period, and as I say, that's what makes it interesting, but though sometimes makes it a bit tedious in the long run when people
do you think that this is why dogmas were introduced, to keep keep peace, to say, well, that's now the rule and that's it,
yeah,
so no more discussion.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say about the definition of dogma in the early church, is that it's very often not a way of defining something positively, but simply a way of closing off roads that people shouldn't inquire down. So very rarely do the early dogmatic statements say, this is what we believe, although there are a few of those. It's usually, this is what we don't believe, as a way of kind of marking the boundaries within which discussion can keep taking place. The church has never not been argumentative, as the New Testament shows.
For those of you who have just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out our website or our Facebook page at Tengaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is Nick Thompson, who is Senior Lecturer in Theological and Religious Studies at the University of Auckland. He specializes in the history of Christianity. Well, in these next weeks, we are going to hear a lot about Luther, about Martin Luther. Can you describe a bit the religious life in Europe before Luther, or when Luther grew up?
Well, the life in the Western Church, by which I mean the Latin-speaking Church of Western and Southern Europe, on the eve of the Reformation, was tremendously rich and diverse, and it's often quite hard to generalize because communications still weren't that good. So quite distinctive forms of Western Christianity could grow up, and, you know, for example, there would be a whole lot of difference between the Christianity of the Western Islands of Scotland, where the predominant language was Gaelic, and say what you could find in Sicily. So it's a little bit hard to generalize, but in the cities especially, like Strasbourg and Paris and Naples, the laity for really the first time in Christian history were taking control of large parts of church life and were taking responsibility for their own learning. For example, you'll find groups of wealthy lay people banding together, pooling their money to buy a theologically trained clergyman, often someone who's just graduated from the university, who will be what they call a lecturer, someone who will give them regular sermons and, you know, a form of sort of evening class on Christianity. And one, obviously one of the other huge, I suppose, game changers, to use a cliche in this period, is the arrival of the printing press, which makes it possible to mass produce texts relatively cheaply for the first time. And contrary to the stereotype, the church was very, very keen on printing, regarded it as a kind of a gift from God, and one of the largest publishers at this time was the church, printing not just, you know, ecclesiastical texts, things like sacramentaries and other prayer books, but also devotional texts for the use of the laity. So lay people, wealthy women in particular, are becoming literate at rates that they had never been in human history. And one of the main things they're interested in is learning about their faith. So you get this quite a new kind of literate devotion. And the ironic thing is that it's often those kinds of people, in a sense, the best Catholics, who often become the first Protestants as well, in the cities especially.
If they could read, and that's already a big difference to the majority of the people who depend on oral tradition.
That's right.
And you'd have all the paintings, and you'd, you know, in the churches, these are the stories of the Bible. They are in the churches. But if somebody can read, they can question differently to the painting. Because with a painting, you leave the painting a lot more open to interpretation than if you have something written.
Yes, although I think one of the stereotypes about the Lutheran Reformation, anyway, maybe not the other forms of Reformation, was that it was tremendously open to religious art, and so that the best example of that is the friendship and the business partnership between Luther and Lucas Cranach, the printer in Wittenberg. Lucas Cranach was both a publisher and a very gifted artist, as was his son. And Cranach, I mean, it's a kind of pejorative term to use, becomes the artistic propagandist of the Reformation, but his propaganda is beautiful. I mean, Lutheran art is absolutely glorious, and Luther deliberately wanted to make use of the visual and the musical riches of the church in which he'd grown up to spread what he understood as his gospel. So there's not always a kind of sharp divide between the visual and the literate, though particularly in Reformed Christianity, the Protestantism of Geneva, for example, art begins to be completely secularized because there's no desire to have it within the churches.
Whereas with Lucas Cranach, I could imagine that as Luther was translating the Bible, he would explain to Lucas what he saw.
Yes.
And then Lucas was depicting what Luther described to him.
Yes.
Or what Luther interpreted out of the text.
Yes. Luther's Bible, people forget, is beautifully illustrated. And people often got artists to colour in the woodcuts and the copies that they bought. And Cranach's art is often you can see that it was intended to work as a kind of, I suppose the way that some preachers use a PowerPoint along with their sermon now, as a kind of a visual representation of some of the verbal doctrinal points that Lutheran preachers were trying to get across in there.
Yeah, I think that the people were also very visual at that time because the majority didn't read and write.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that we're almost swinging back in that direction now. I often think that my students are a lot more visually savvy than I am because they've been raised in a much more visual culture.
I remember that I was in a German church, medieval church, and I saw something on the ceiling that I had never seen. I didn't know what it was. And they said, oh, that's a hole that is covered. But when you have the Ascension in the Middle Ages, you would have the Ascension dramatized. So they used to have drama in the churches.
Yes.
To show it to people because that was what they understood.
And as you say, often with these kind of sort of special effects, you know, the monstrance with the host on it might undergo a kind of a resurrection, a physical resurrection on a pulley at Easter, you know, so they, and this is something the Jesuits were particularly good at in the post-Reformation period, was continuing that kind of wow factor in Christian worship to keep the people coming in. They really understood how to put on a good show.
And so we were talking about Luther now, but I don't want to go too deep into Luther because we are going to have your two presentations at the Mercy Spirituality Center. One of them is called Marking the 500th Anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and the other one is Luther's Gospel, Justification by Faith Alone. And I think that one of the other reformers, Martin Butzer, who was a Dominican, he also was interested in the justification by faith alone, but yet he also wanted to just reform the church. He wanted to bring, some new old ideas in the church and to make sure that this is, that the church is revived. Is that right?
Yes. So, Martin Butzer, he was an admirer of Luther. He heard Luther speaking at the University of Heidelberg in 1518 and came away sort of with his life changed. He was a Dominican friar, theologian, but he got married, became a pastor in the city of Strasbourg. And Strasbourg's one of these cities I was speaking about, very well connected, sitting on the Rhine, so with a lot of ships coming and going and giving people of Strasbourg a sense of what's going on.
And maybe to mention, Strasbourg was German and then French and then German and French, and now it's French since the Second World War.
So, yeah, at this point it was described as an imperial free city, which made it sort of pretty much self-governing. And they had also exiled their bishop. He was still their bishop, but they'd sent him to live out of the city so that the city council, even on before the Reformation started, effectively ran their own church. They were used to running their own church. As I say, Butzer admired Luther, but Luther didn't admire him. Luther thought Butzer was really flaky, prepared to please anybody. But so Luther often he operates as a provocateur. He will often say quite shockingly rude things in order to startle people into rethinking conventional beliefs. Butzer takes a much more softly approach, and he models it on St. Paul, who says, I made myself all things to all people in order that I might draw some to the fullness of the truth. So Butzer's understanding of Reformation is something that happens very gradually, and you've got to take the slowest members of the church with you. So this is why he often appears to be more conservative in some ways than Luther was, because he worries about those he describes as the weak. We would describe them as the kind of more traditionalist Catholics, the people who don't want rapid change. And so Butzer has the sense of a church that encompasses the whole of the city. How am I going to bring the whole of the city into this reformed church? And he's also some people describe him as a Puritan. We might say that he had a passion for social justice, although it might not be social justice in the way that we understand it. But Butzer wants to make society holy. That's the way that he would put it. So he realizes that to do that, that the more committed lay people have to be involved, as well. It can't just be something that the clergy does. So within every parish in the Church of Strasbourg, he establishes what are called Gemeinde, or kind of, we would describe them as Christian communities, groups of very, very committed members of the parish who'll take responsibility alongside the clergy for the running of the parish and for the supervision of the other members of the parish. So we often speak about shared ministry today. That this is something that Boetzer believed in very strongly. But he also, because of the sense that he wanted to bring everybody with him in the Reformation, invested a huge amount of effort in trying to negotiate with those who are often called the old believers, we might call them the Catholics, the traditionalists who didn't want to change, not just in Strasbourg, but in the whole of Europe, trying to reach some kind of deal that would keep everybody together in the same church. And this is why Luther didn't approve of him, although Luther in his own way was quite conservative about some things like religious art. He thought that Boetzer was always compromising too far with the old church. And eventually Boetzer realized his plans had completely failed, and the Emperor Charles V invaded Strasbourg, and Boetzer was sent into exile in England, which at that point was the last surviving Protestant country in Europe. Briefly, the Reformation was completely defeated in Germany. So Boetzer, in some ways, is a kind of tragic figure in that he died watching his vision for the reform of the church completely collapse and fail, except for in England. He had a tremendous impact on the Church of England, but he died a kind of broken man in England. He'd had to leave his wife in Strasbourg. He had an intellectually handicapped son who the English wouldn't take as a refugee, so he had to leave him in Strasbourg.
Oh, well, these are laws. But also, I think that his wife passed away, and because there were lots of diseases at that time.
He had, now let me see, I can't remember whether it's two or three wives. There's one of the wives, I think I'm right about this, Elizabeth Silbereisen, who gets passed around among a number of reformers who predecease her.
He marries his friend's widow.
Yes, that's right, yeah. But she had been married to somebody else before she married his friend.
It's like in the Bible with a lady whose husbands pass on, and
that's right.
Who does she belong to in heaven?
That's right.
Yeah. So Boetzer, both of them were martyrs. Well, Martin Boetzer, I think, was born on the 11th of November, the day of St. Martin of Tours.
That's
and
right.
Martin is a very popular name among the Catholics especially, but
yes.
I'm sure also among the Lutherans, with Martin Luther being the head of the church. But how come in the Lutheran churches I don't see many pictures? You usually see Psalms and you see a picture of Luther.
Pictures of Boetzer?
No, with Luther in the Lutheran churches, when we talk about the pictures, and
I think it depended on the region of the Lutheran world. So if you go to Nuremberg, for example, in Germany, or if you go to Scandinavia, where the Lutheran Reformations are often described as being more conservative, the art was kept, and you can still see it there today. So, for example, in Nuremberg, there was a period in the early Reformation where they felt under some obligation to take the religious art down. But a lot of the families felt a kind of proprietary interest in these statues because they had donated them to the church. So they weren't going to have them ripped out and smashed in the way they were in some countries, for example, in the Netherlands. So they repossessed them. The art simply went back to the families. And once the reformer Andreas Osiander became the leader of the Reformation in Nuremberg, he said, well, we don't need to worry about this. Luther's fine with religious painting. It can all go back. So if you go to the Lutheran churches, there are like, I think, St. Sebald.
In Nuremberg, yeah.
There's lots of pre-Reformation.
So in that way, Luther was fine with some part of the tradition.
Yes.
And Butzer, I'm sure, would also have been fine, because if he tried to keep within the Catholic Church and just try to reform, maybe he was intending something like a Vatican Council or something like that.
Interestingly, Butzer was much more hostile toward both art and even music than Luther was. So Butzer definitely thought that, as he says, images should be taken out of the temples. When he was in negotiation with the Catholics, he was prepared grudgingly to let them keep their images, but he didn't want any images in his churches. And similarly with music, he was reluctant to have any musical instruments in church. In the Strasbourg churches kept the organ. Now, that was considered sort of moderate in the time. The church in Zurich, for example, just banned singing altogether. And even, it should be said, the Council of Trent had a debate about whether there should be organs in churches or whether church music should simply be unaccompanied. And the organ only just won out, as it did in Strasbourg. And Butzer thought he preferred that only the psalms be sung in church. They kept, I think, about three hymns, but only three hymns, whereas Luther's attitude towards church music was much more laissez-faire. There could be all kinds of instruments, not just organs. You know, you could have viols and dulcimers and horns and things like that. And also, as most people know, Luther was a very enthusiastic hymn writer, so there's this really impressive and beautiful repertoire of Lutheran hymnody, the kind of thing that Bach uses when he's writing his cantatas.
So we're 500 years since the Reformation, and it was not just one opinion.
Yeah.
There were lots of opinions and different reformers with different interests.
Yes.
And all strongly believing in what they came up with. And I think that would be really interesting when you're going to give the two talks at our center.
Thank you.
The one on the beginning of the 500 years of and it starts with Luther had no intention of breaking with the papacy. So that's interesting. So we'll see what you're going to talk about this. That's on the 30th of October. And then justification by faith alone. That's even today a discussion, and I hear it often between Catholics. Faith alone, or do you have to earn the sacrament, for example? And so that will be the second part, and that's on the 6th of November. So we're looking forward to this.
Okay.
And quickly, what else is coming up? Well, on the 28th and the 29th of October, Sister Anne Warren will facilitate a workshop on exploring life transitions. Well, these are also kind of life transitions. And on the 15th of November, from 7 to 9 p.m., Deacon Danny Karatea Gotthard will come to our center and give a presentation with the title, God Speaks to Me in Māori. He will help us looking at the story of the coming of the Word in Christianity through Maori eyes. For all our events at the center, please register with us per phone at 09-638-6238 or via our website at www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.